Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 06-5139. Henry W. Seeger, individually and on behalf of those of the class of all other similarly situated, et al., versus Alberto Gonzalez, Attorney General of the United States, et al., appellants. Ms. Weinstein for the appellants, Ms. Gilfond for the appellees.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Laurie Weinstein. I'm here for the appellant, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for my rebuttal. We are here today because the district court did not comply with Rule 52 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, nor with the repeated instructions from this court with regard to necessary findings and support for the entry of an injunction.
Can I ask a threshold question, which is it the government's position that there's a contract?
Yes, Your Honor. And the district court was quite clear in doing his analysis of the underlying proceedings as though it were a contract dispute.
Right, but do you agree with the district court's finding that there wasn't the formation of a contract?
Not quite, Your Honor. We do agree there was no meeting
position,
of the minds.
I just want to be clear on this. Your position is that there is a contract.
There is a contract, Your Honor, and to the extent there was no meeting of the minds, which ordinarily would obviate a contract from being formed, the contract in this port, there was no meeting of the minds because of the appellees slash plaintiffs.
What's your position on whether there was a meeting of the minds?
Your Honor, we're not challenging the district court's findings in that regard. We think he was incorrect in his application of the law.
Okay.
So your position is there was no meeting of the minds?
Your Honor, our position is it does not matter whether there was a meeting of the minds or not. The issue before the court was, did appellee's conscious ignorance of what the intent of the stipulation was require the court to enforce it with DEA's interpretation or to vacate it?
Isn't there a precursor question? Was there a meeting of the minds? Suppose we concluded the contract was perfectly clear.
We believe, Your Honor, the contract was perfectly clear. The meeting of the minds part can't be separated from the conscious ignorance of the appellees in this matter.
Did you raise in your briefs a challenge to the meeting of the minds part of the argument or only to the conscious ignorance part?
No, Your Honor. What we said in the briefs was because of the conscious ignorance, that the fact that the judge found no meeting of the minds was not controlling because there was no meeting of the minds.
So the only element of contract formation that is at issue before us today is the conscious ignorance argument. Is that right? If you're right about that, then you win. But you're not challenging the other elements of meeting of the minds.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Suppose we concluded, is it open to us to conclude that the appellee's reading of the contract is perfectly clear and correct?
Actually, Your Honor, I don't believe it is for the reasons set forth in the district court's findings with regard to that. The district court specifically found with regard to, one, the conscious ignorance that they knew there was a disputed provision that they did not inquire about, but two, also that the plain meaning of the language in the footnote of the stipulation, which is the nub of the whole thing here, that the word to fill couldn't possibly have meant what the plaintiffs said it meant.
That's a question of law, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. Your panel here.
For us, could we conclude that the appellee's reading of the contract is the correct one?
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor.
We could. And then what?
No, actually, you couldn't based on the findings, Your Honor. But
the findings assume there's ambiguity, doesn't it? If we conclude it's not ambiguous and that the contract means what the appellees argue it means, then what happens? Is that before us?
Your Honor, the inherent language of the part of the stipulation that was at issue before the district court eliminates the possibility that the appellees' position could be correct as enforced because the plain language does not mean what the appellees said it meant.
You're fighting with my hypothetical instead of accepting the hypothetical and going on. We conclude, is it open for us to conclude that the appellees' initial position was correct, that the contract means what they say it means, the plain meaning means what they say it means, and therefore, what would then be your position?
Your Honor, you are free to do that because this court will review that particular issue de novo. So
right.
This court is free to do that.
And then what happens? And what is your position?
Well, Your Honor, you must find that the you must determine that the district court's findings with regard to that were clearly erroneous.
Findings? It's a question of law, isn't it? What a contract means is a question of law. Unless there's ambiguity, if we conclude there was no ambiguity, the contract means what the appellees claimed it meant originally.
In order to do that, Your Honor, you're going to have to make a stretch as to what the appellees say that the contract meant. That's just not supported by the plain language of the stipulation itself.
Why is it such a stretch to read footnote 1 in the context of all the other provisions of the stipulation to say footnote 1, given the other provisions, clearly means that the administrator retains the discretion only to select from the people on the list, not the discretion to go off list? Why isn't that perfectly reasonable, plain meaning interpretation of the footnote?
Because the word to fill, Your Honor, doesn't have that meaning. The district court discussed it at some length, but all the testimony below.
What about all the provisions in the text that say candidates will be considered only if they apply?
That's subsequent to the
and that the administrator will make his selection or non-selection from the list of candidates.
Right. It lets the administrator make a non-selection to begin with. And the footnote was placed at the very beginning of the stipulation and was very clear that it reserved the administrator's existing authority. The existing authority was found in 5 U.S.C. 3151, which said that the only
thing... That would be clear if all you had was footnote 1, perhaps. But when you read footnote 1 in context, as we're required to do in a contract, it seems much more likely that footnote 1 means simply that the administrator has the discretion to select from people on the list, not to go off list. Why is that wrong?
That's wrong, Your Honor, because of where the footnote was in the stipulation. It was an overriding consideration for everything else that came in that
process. Why even have the other pages of the stipulation? Why not just have footnote 1? That would have been the whole thing. The administrator retains the complete discretion to select who he or she wants.
Your Honor, what the bargain was in this case between the parties was that the DEA would adopt a systematic procedure for being able to select people to the SES.
Exactly. How is it systematic if footnote 1 completely eliminates all the procedures that are set out in the text of the stipulation?
The footnote does not eliminate all the procedures that are set out.
Your position is that the footnote gives the administrator the complete authority to fill any position that's at issue off list at any time for any reason. Isn't that your position?
Your Honor,
I know it's not done that way a lot, but that's your position.
Your Honor, that is the statutory authority of the administrator that was not changed by the stipulation. However, Your Honor, the benefit of the bargain in this stipulation was that prior to this time, people who were interested in...
Let me interrupt you about the statutory authority. Is it your position somehow that the personnel statute overrides Title VII?
No, Your Honor. DEA is absolutely required to comply with Title VII.
And this is a stipulation that was entered into in a Title VII case, correct?
That is correct,
so
Your Honor.
So what does the personnel statute have to do with the price of tea?
Your Honor, the stipulation was a means of accommodating and ensuring compliance with Title VII. However, in terms of analysis of what the stipulation meant, you have to look at it through contract law terms. In what the stipulation had to do with Title VII and the price of tea, Your Honor, was that you had to, we were working with the plaintiffs to get a system whereby people who did not have an opportunity to be considered for the SES could then be considered for the SES.
The question was, what does it have to do with the statutory section on discretion? You agree that a Title VII remedy can override that statutory section, or at least is consistent with it, or do you not agree with that? If as a necessary remedy to solve a Title VII violation, some kind of limitation on the administrator's discretion is required, that overrides the general statutory provision for discretion, doesn't it?
That's correct, and that would most likely...
That's what Judge Silberman ruled in the Lander case, right? That's exactly what was ruled in that case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So I guess what both of us are asking is, what does this general statutory section, which says that the administrator has discretion, have to do with the situation in which Title VII liability has already been found?
Your Honor, that's the that gets us back to the crux of the matter, that the district court, after denying the appellee's motion for an injunction, then went ahead and enjoined DEA. And contrary to law, both of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and the law of this court, the district court went ahead and enjoined DEA without setting forth the reasons for.
That's a different issue. That's an issue about whether the interlocutory remedy here is appropriate or not. But it's not a question about the meaning of the statute. You put an awful lot of emphasis in your brief on how this statute gives the DEA administrator unfettered discretion. In fact, apparently somebody testified that the DEA administrator under this statute is allowed to discriminate on the basis of race if the administrator wants to. You don't believe that, do you?
No, I don't believe that, Your Honor. In fact, that's exactly what would be a Title VII violation. The person who testified to that, former DEA Administrator Marshall, also went on to testify, as we clarified in our brief, that he couldn't imagine such a thing happening because everybody knew that would be against the law and that it would be completely contrary to any intelligent exercise of the administrator's authority.
I don't see why the 3151 applies at all, because the only thing it says is that the positions may be appointed without regard to the provisions of this title. Well, Title VII's separate title of the U.S. Code, so it's not even, why is 3151 relevant at all?
Because one of the challenges to the selection process as it existed and the Title VII challenge that was brought to it was that it did not conform with the SES selection process that was generally accepted throughout the government with regard to the requirement to have the ranking and rating of individuals and then the selection from that list.
Isn't the order here enforcing Title VII?
I think the...
Which is a separate title in the U.S. Code, thereby making 3151 completely irrelevant to this case?
The district court cannot issue an injunction without considering the state of the law and tailoring his injunctive remedy to the most narrowly tailored effective
remedy. That's a separate argument. I'm just making the point, or trying to, that I think 3151 on its face is irrelevant to this case, given its language.
I disagree, Your Honor. I don't think it is irrelevant. I think it's
a brooding omnipresence that should cast its shadow over the case. Is that your point?
I don't think it would be a shadow so much as illumination, Your Honor.
It's very good.
That's good.
So I think in that context, the district court was required to consider what the existing state of the law was. He was required to consider the equities involved in issuing an injunction.
Before we get to the injunction, which we certainly will get to, I still want to ask a question to follow up the question that was begun on the contract meaning. Is your argument that you have a long stipulation which requires people to be listed on a list and to be taken from the list, and then you have a footnote that says, never mind? Is that the point? That the footnote says, never mind, nothing in this, in the end, fetters the discretion of the administrator, and the administrator could appoint everyone off-list?
No, Your Honor. The administrator could appoint everyone off-list, but only after he or she had complied with the process that had been implemented.
That's not your position.
It makes the process ridiculous, doesn't it?
That's not your position. The person here was selected off-list.
After, and this was testified to by Administrator Tandy and Michelle.
But your interpretation of the footnote, as I understand it, is that anyone could be selected off-list.
That's correct. That is the statutory authority that the administrator has.
That's
the footnote specifically.
The question I guess we're asking is, on the face of a contract which has a very long list of requirements, why, and even if there's some tiny or some small amount of ambiguity, why should we read the contract as a footnote to the contract basically saying, never mind, to six pages of, or I don't know, even more pages of the contract?
I think that's based on a misapprehension of what the contract was to accomplish, Your Honor. The contract was to accomplish opportunity for plaintiff class members to apply and be considered. The state of affairs prior to this stipulation was that possible selectees for the senior executive service were determined by the career board. And it was done in a way that if people on the career board, you know, happened to know someone's work, happened to know about them because they worked with them once, that person had a better chance of getting...
Isn't the underlying purpose of this stipulation to prevent continued violations of Title VII, that is, to prevent continued discrimination on the basis of race? Wasn't that the reason for this?
The stipulation was intended, Your Honor, to maintain the current state of actual diversity that the SES at DEA had at the time.
Really? I thought those aspects were vacated. The elements about quotas and everything had been earlier vacated. And what we have here is something that's supposed to set up an objective procedure which mitigates to the extent possible discrimination on the basis of race, in order to provide objective criteria for people advancing and transparency, so we know who's advancing and why they're advancing. Wasn't that what it was for?
It was to provide transparency to the process and to allow a greater scrutiny of that. However,
how does appointing somebody who's not on the list, whose qualifications haven't been listed, how does that do that? I mean, it may well be the case that the person appointed, that this decision is non-discriminatory, but when you have a system set up to provide transparency, how does appointing somebody whose qualifications have not been listed in this way on a list, how does it do that?
Your Honor, because there is going to be a record of exactly what was done in the case. This is not something that was done in secret. The person who was selected and the specific person who was involved in this, there was a great deal of testimony in the court below as to what qualifications that person had that were not located on anybody on the list.
Right,
that were necessary.
The only way that was able to come out was by discovery in a lawsuit, and we don't want, neither you want that, nor does the other side want that, nor really does the court want that. The point of this system was to set up so you could see these qualifications, and you yourself argued we don't want to have a situation in fact, with respect to this injunction, your main complaint is that the judge says you can't appoint somebody off-list without my approval. And there's no set of standards about that, and you don't want to litigate about whether or not somebody's qualifications are correct. I'm right about this, right? That's your argument.
That's correct, because the judge vacated the stipulation that existed that provided the process
right,
by which
somebody
people
who
would
be appointed off-list, how does anybody know that person's qualifications and how they stack up against the others until there's litigation?
The way this has worked predominantly and entirely, there's been one selection off list in the entire history of the stipulation. That was done in accordance with the stipulation in that there was a review of the people on the list who had applied and were interested in being selected prior to the selection of the person who was deemed most qualified to fulfill the position that was being filled, which you fill by promotion. Because of that, it's not going to likely be, and DEA is committed to the stipulation as it existed with the DEA's interpretation that for rare exceptions, as was testified by both former DEA administrators.
I understand that. So I understand you might have a contract in which you have a footnote that says, in rare circumstances where the administrator can't find anybody on the list, she's authorized to appoint somebody off. But this doesn't say that. This footnote, if we were to interpret it the way you want to interpret it, we would have to say no limitation, right? It says these procedures are meant to systemize the process. Nothing is meant to reduce the authority of the administrator. And if your view is that the administrator has unfettered authority, this is not a footnote about once in a blue moon we're going to appoint somebody, or even, which would be perfectly all right in a non-discriminatory world, I'm going to appoint my friend. That's not discriminatory based on race. That's discrimination based on who my friends are and who aren't, which I understand is part of the attack on the particular appointee in this case. But it doesn't say that either. In order for us to adopt your view, we have to adopt the view that this is an unfettered footnote, don't we?
I think under the statute, the administrator's authority is unfettered, and this refers to the administrator's authority.
May I bring you back, because you don't have an awful lot of time yet, and I'd like to focus. Let's assume that the court concludes that the contract, the stipulation is rather clear, and we do not accept your interpretation at all. And we accept the appellee's initial interpretation as it was presented before the district court. Then what is your position?
our position at that point, Your Honor, would be that you would be wrong.
Maybe I can help you on this for just one second. I thought your position was then the district court should consider your underlying motion that we don't need this injunction anymore. We don't need this stipulation anymore. It's 20 years later. Things have changed. The DEA is a new DEA. And now the court can consider removing the stipulation.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And
I was hoping you would answer
I use the word court here, it wouldn't be this court. It would be the district court,
It would be the district court. And, Your Honor, the district court had before him, prior to the appeal, a motion to dismiss all orders relating to the SES because of the DEA's demonstrated compliance. Now, that motion was not given a chance to be fully litigated because upon our notice of appeal, the district court dismissed it without prejudice. But certainly, the DEA is anxious for that motion to be resolved. What we think about this particular appeal is that the court did not have any basis to enjoin DEA in the manner in which he did, and two, that the stipulation should have been interpreted as DEA and all DEA witnesses consistently said should have been interpreted.
Well, you could, in fact, go back to the district court and say, look, we have a track record of non-discrimination, at least in the last 20 years or 10 years, and under these circumstances, and we are happy with the current system, which I understand you are, that's right? Generally, you like the idea of going off list, right?
Well, you generally like the idea of having the selection
process.
I
mean, of taking somebody from a list, not off list.
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor. In fact,
but you want a couple exceptions. You want every once in a while for the administrator to make an exception, make an exception. Well, I mean, that's a pretty limited request. So you could make that request to the district court and say we want to modify the stipulation at least in that way.
Or you could actually, or what I think you have done, is move to abandon the case, to drop the jurisdiction of the case because it's outmoded.
That's correct. That's what we have done before the district court.
But you don't have a ruling on that. Or you have a dismissal without prejudice.
Right. And we will have to refile that. But we wouldn't need to do that, Your Honor,
if you win today, I know.
No, Your Honor, if the court had interpreted the stipulation as DEA interpreted the stipulation, we would be working along fine doing the stipulation,
Because the administrator would have unfettered authority to hire off list.
Yeah. The administrator
let me ask you one more question on the contract interpretation. If your interpretation of footnote 1 is correct, why is there the provision in the text that says, at the agency's discretion, vacant SES positions also may be filled by lateral transfers of current SES employees? That would be entirely unnecessary language if your interpretation of footnote 1 were correct.
The reference to lateral transfers had to be included because the issue of lateral transfers has been a huge issue with
throughout the lawsuit. I understand that, but it would be totally unnecessary language if your interpretation of footnote 1 were correct.
I don't believe it would be, Your Honor, because we still adopted the process. The fact that there's a reservation of ultimate authority does not denigrate or obliterate the process. The process was an important thing for the plaintiff class to achieve.
And the text indicates one exception for vacant positions where lateral transfers can occur. So that makes it odd to think that footnote 1 would mean, and by the way, this whole process, including the lateral transfers, is entirely discretionary. It's just an odd interpretation of the footnote.
We think it's entirely consistent with the DEA's position on how the stipulation should have been interpreted, Your Honor.
In graphic terms, the footnote is the elephant and the 6 pages of stipulation is the mouse.
The 6 pages of stipulations, Your Honor, is what the plaintiffs bargained for. At the time it was adopted, there was no discrimination in DEA.
Can I just be clear on the general policy position of the DEA? The DEA is happy with a system in which the SES promotions are done from a list. And all it wants is an occasional exception when necessary, without defining what necessary means. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, we'll hear from the other side.
Thank you.
Ms. Gelfand?
May it please the court, my name is Rebecca Gelfand, and I represent the appellees. The district court's 2006 injunction should be affirmed, But preceding that question is whether or not there was, in fact, a valid agreement between the parties that would have which would mean that the district court erred when it said that the 2002 stipulated procedures should, in fact, have been vacated.
And it's your position that there was a valid agreement, correct?
Well, we would take the position that it was plain on the face of the contract that our interpretation, the plaintiff's interpretation, was correct.
So that's yes?
Yes.
Okay. And why didn't you cross-appeal?
We did not cross-appeal because
your interpretation would broaden the relief beyond what the district court granted.
The reason we didn't cross-appeal, Your Honor, is because we took, for strategic reasons, we decided not to appeal the merits. However, had we known that the DEA was going to have appealed the merits of its decision, we certainly would have cross-appealed the decision so that we would clearly have before the court the ability to determine that the contract should be interpreted in favor of the plaintiffs on its plain meaning, which position we do take here. But specifically with respect to the 2006 injunction, we believe that the district court, in an effort to manage a case in which racial discrimination was proven 27 years ago and which the court-ordered procedures required by that finding haven't been implemented, was well within its discretion to implement the minimally intrusive and bare-bones injunction at issue here. Rather than allow a standardless...
Counsel,
yes.
You know our rules of court discourage reading arguments.
Your Honor, I apologize. I'm just a little bit nervous, but I will attempt
to
avoid.
Don't be nervous. Just talk with us.
Yes, Your Honor.
We'll help you in a minute because we're going to start asking questions.
And
I'll ask now. With the question of footnote one, the DEA's interpretation, they say the rest of the text is not meaningless because it, in fact, sets up a procedure that ensures that applicants get on a list. And half the battle in government hiring decisions is getting on the list in the first place. And so all these procedures at least ensure that you get on the list, and then the administrator, if he or she chooses, can go off list. Why isn't that not a way to accommodate the text and the footnote in a reasonable way?
The problem with that interpretation, Your Honor, is that it's not supported at all by the plain language of the agreement, but only, if at all, by testimony from the DEA's agents, particularly the upper-level administrators. If you look at the footnote itself, in order to see the DEA's interpretation of it in the second sentence, you would have to be reading it to permit the DEA to have unfettered discretion. And if that was the case, there's no reason why the DEA would be bound by the other procedures that are set forth in the stipulated procedures themselves.
You all were aware of this footnote being inserted, right? There was it was presented, it was highlighted, discussed. No one raised an objection to the footnote, even though I would have thought you would look at a footnote like that or language like that, and that would be a lot of red flags. Do you know why no one raised an objection to that language?
There was much testimony on this below,
yes,
and it was the plaintiff's position is that although they did have questions about it, based on the text of the procedures themselves, which clearly indicate that there is an absolute process set forth, which has no suggestion that it would have any exceptions, as well as the working group's evaluation of it, that the interpretation of the footnote was merely the proper interpretation of the footnote would be merely to preserve the administrator's discretion within the process. In other words, to promote any candidate off of the best
qualified. Wouldn't it have made sense to make that specific? I mean, I just
plaintiffs take the position. I understand your point, Your Honor, but plaintiffs take the position that the language is itself unambiguous in favor of us, such that the DEA's interpretation at the time is in all honesty somewhat outlandish because it is entirely inconsistent with the entire point of the procedures being implemented, which is to comply with the 1981 order that required validated procedures to be put in place.
So you're too young to have written the footnote anyway, so that's not your fault.
I appreciate your comment, but actually that's not true.
I
did not write the footnote. The DEA here, and this is actually relevant, the DEA here was the sole drafter, and admittedly so, of the footnote. So the notion that somehow plaintiffs had an obligation to confirm our understanding with the DEA is contrary to this presumption in contract law that the drafter of the footnote bears the burden of any ambiguity. So
presumably
now,
you,
may I ask you a question that goes to now, we do not have before us, and there's no legitimate way we could have before us, the underlying motion to question the continuing jurisdiction of the court.
But correct.
What is your position with respect to the underlying motion that which the which of course is that DEA has twice as many minority SESs as the government as a whole, and there's no indication of discrimination over the last 20 years, so why are we still flogging a dead horse?
The 1981 order is still necessary, Your Honor. Although the DEA points to evidence that there's no discriminatory impact in the SES, that is not really surprising to plaintiffs, because if you look back at the original 1981 finding of liability, it wasn't based on statistical evidence of disparate impact in the supergrades, because the number of appointments in those areas are so small, you cannot, at least the 1981 finding was, that you couldn't make statistical findings of disparate impact. The finding of liability was instead based on the notions that there was discrimination in the preceding grade levels, as well as discrimination in the evaluation processes and the disciplinary process and work assignments.
But isn't it fair to say that 25 years later there ought to be some kind of examination as to whether there is any continuing?
I don't disagree that the DEA is perfectly within its rights to refile its motion to terminate and have that determined on the merits, but we take the position that we have a very strong response to that.
Which is?
Which is that we would want discovery into the surrounding elements of the promotion process to see if there's other elements of discrimination other than a mere statistical analysis.
So this is before you get to the SES. Is that what you're saying, that there may be discrimination before you get on the list in the first place?
Pipeline problems, yes, Your Honor.
Can I ask you about the injunction then for a second here? There was an initial flurry of dispute about whether this was interlocutory or permanent.
Yes.
I take it you were taking the position that it was permanent and therefore a lower standard of explanation was required. Is that right?
Yes, they take...
Is that right?
Yes.
And but I take it from your 28J letter, you no longer take that position. You agree that it's interlocutory.
No, Your Honor.
No, you don't.
The mere fact that it's temporary in duration does not make it an interlocutory injunction. By definition...
Counsel, does it make any difference? Does it make any
That was going
difference?
To be my next question. That was going to be my next question.
We tend to think alike. Does it really make any difference whether it's a final order or a preliminary order? Or don't we still have to look at the underlying reasons for it?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct, that you need to look at the underlying reasons, and we believe...
I must say, I thought this dispute was a bit of a tempest in a teapot. But in any event...
He likes tea, you see. This is now the second analogy on tea. And you don't actually think that we would look less closely at a permanent injunction than we would at an interlocutory injunction, do you? I mean, that would seem to be the argument, that, you know, this is a permanent injunction, not an interlocutory one, and therefore the requirements are lower.
As set forth by the plain terms of the rules.
Well, that's an interpretation rule 52 that I find surprising. I wonder whether there's any cases. Rule 52 says that the court shall find that in actions tried upon the facts without a jury, which this underlying action was tried because it was an injunction
Correct.
Action, the court shall find the facts specifically, state separately its conclusions and judgment. And in granting and refusing a interlocutory injunction, the court shall similarly set forth the findings, etc. That strikes me that what the rule writers are saying is that they're to be treated similarly, not that for some reason permanent injunctions are going to be easier and less explained than interlocutory ones. Am I wrong about that?
Yes, Your Honor. The rule by its terms...
I just read the terms. Which part of the
...do not apply to permanent injunctions. They apply to judgments. In this case, is the 1981 judgment.
You can't have a permanent injunction without first having a judgment, right?
Correct. And in this instance, the 1981 judgment was well supported by findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Yes, but you don't think that the injunction also has to be well supported? Only the judgment? Only the liability finding has to be supported? Not the decision to grant an injunction?
Based on a plain reading of the rules, that is our position.
Is there any case that says that?
We base our analysis on the plain reading and have not found contrary law in this circuit.
Found any law in any circuit? that distinguishes between an interlocutory and a permanent injunction with respect to how much explanation is required. Is that
right? I can't speak today about law in the other circuit on this issue, but I can say, Your Honor,
you can speak to the question whether you found anything.
I don't know. I can say that there is suggestion in treatises that it does have a broader application.
Okay.
What isn't really what's going on here is you want as much as possible to go back to 1981, and the government wants to come up to the present, and this is really a struggle over that question in the guise of a procedural fight?
Yes, Your Honor. We take the position that the procedural fight is irrelevant because the judge was certainly in its discretion, well within its discretion, to enter this order.
Look back to that 1981 finding and say, okay, everything that happens afterwards is justified by the 1981 finding. It doesn't have to have any other justification.
Yes, until that order is modified.
As Judge Garland points out, a new injunction has to be justified even if it is based on a 1981 finding.
Yes. If you take that position, which I understand is a reasonable one, that going outside of the plain language of the rule and just looking at whether or not the district court had enough sufficient findings on the record, we take the position that he clearly did. He had the 1981 finding of liability that showed discrimination in the upper levels of promotion processes, and he also had the existing 1981 order that required the implementation.
Does it make any sense, counsel, to be basing an order today on findings back 25 years ago without any examination of whether that situation obtains today?
Certainly it does in this case, Your Honor.
Does it?
It does. The district court had before it clear evidence that of the fact that the DEA had no indication that it was actually complying with the court's order. In fact, before this court today, the DEA is taking the position that it has unfettered discretion in making promotions to the SES. Faced with that 25 years of noncompliance, the district court was well within its discretion to introduce this minimally intrusive injunction.
Accepting your argument about Rule 52, we still have Rule 65, which says the court has to give a reason, right?
Yes.
Right. But the reason you're giving, the court did not give. The court did not give any reason as to why 30 days would be required or as to why the court's approval would be required, right?
The court did not specifically, you're correct, that
the
court.
I got the word specifically.
The court did not.
Did the court give any reason?
No, Your Honor, the court did not give a reason for the specifics of its injunction. However, it did justify the general injunction, the need for the injunction based on the noncompliance with 1981 because the 2002 stipulated procedures were vacated. And we take the, and if
tell me what sentence is the explanation in the order. It's the order's on page, the relevant part, I take it, is on page 157.
Yes, it says on JA 128, actually, Your Honor.
Well, unfortunately, I've got the actual.
Let me find the cross reference for you.
Isn't it at page 157 of the opinion?
It's 85. I'm sorry. There's two page numbers going on. We have the original opinion and then the published citations.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, I think that is correct. In the last paragraph of the conclusion, the court states, as a result of the finding of no meeting of the minds, the parties are back in the position they were in before the stipulated procedures were entered, and DEA must satisfy the court that it has complied with this court's order of February 6, 1981.
So the reason would be that we're back in the position we were in before. That's to the extent there is a reason.
Yes.
That's the reason.
Yes.
Right. So I look at the original order in the case, and it doesn't order the DEA to give 30 days notice, and it doesn't order the DEA to get approval from the court. All it orders, now I'm reading from the opinion,
the 81 opinion,
all it orders is that defendants shall cease such discrimination forthwith. Seems like an appropriate thing to order. That the defendant shall immediately commence validity studies, and that the defendant shall ensure that such systems as operated have neither a disparate impact nor effectuate disparate treatment. But there never was an order, a 30-day order, was there?
No, there was no 30-day order. However, the district court I see that my time is up, but if I may answer the question. The district courts...
Now you can relax because you're not prepared for these questions, I know.
Well, that you are
prepared. You are prepared, but you don't have it written.
The district court's 2006 injunction was far less intrusive than the 1981 order.
Oh, yes, was less. Uh-huh.
Was less intrusive than the 1981 order.
Well, the 1981 order says stop discriminating. That seems... That seems non-intrusive, just says don't discriminate anymore.
Right, but the 1981 order, in combination with the 1982 remedial order, has consistently been interpreted by the parties and is clear on the text to require the DEA to implement validated, non-discriminatory promotion systems that neither have a disparate impact nor affect disparate treatment.
Where was that ordered?
The 1982 order?
You know, where did it say? I see where it says you had to prepare these things. I haven't ever seen an order where there was an agreement as to what a validated study was and required, except for your stipulation, that which has apparently been vacated by the district court. What order required something like anything like this, or even anything more that hasn't been vacated? Which order are you pointing me at?
The parties have consistently throughout this litigation interpreted.
No, but you got to tell me what words
right.
You're interpreting.
It's in 1981. The court order specifically states that the DEA must immediately commence validity studies in order to implement effective non-discriminatory promotion systems.
I understand, but it didn't order the systems because there weren't any. All it did was at that point order validity studies, which would then lead to.
Right. And then the 1982 remedial order ordered that upon completion of the validity studies required by the 1981 order, that they must proceed to develop and implement new non-discriminatory employment systems with respect to promotions.
Right, so they have to develop and implement,
Right. And it goes on to say that once these new systems are in place, defendants shall ensure that the new systems neither have a disparate impact on black agents nor effectuate disparate treatment of black agents.
So I guess what I'm looking for is an explanation why this 30-day requirement, and particularly judicial approval of a specific appointment,
right.
That.
And my explanation.
I'm not saying it can't be done. I don't want your explanation. I want the court's explanation. I mean, there is no explanation from the court as to why. This is the same as this takes us back to the previous position.
The district court did not say why it was setting forth a 30-day requirement, but this court is well within its rights to look to the record and see if it is sufficient to justify the district court's minimally intrusive order. And I think that it is clear that you can do this, and the reason is that although the district court's order requires notice and approval before going off list, that is itself an exception to having a bare-bones merit-based process in which an applicant applies, is rated and ranked, and placed on a qualified list. And the district court's order actually permits the DEA to go outside of that system on notice and approval. So the district court's order is far more lenient than the requirement in the 1981 order.
What standards will the district court apply in deciding whether to approve?
The district court did not specify. However, we can only think that some sort of Title VII principle would apply.
What kind of Title VII principle would apply to an individual promotion off list?
Whether or not discrimination took place in that promotion.
And how, so you would have what kind of case involving that? So you would have a full-blown Title VII trial with respect to that. That is, the government would say, we appointed them because they're the best person, and you would say, no, there's six other people who are better. That you would have a regular Title VII trial?
No, Your Honor, we don't take the position, and certainly we don't believe that the district court would interpret his own order that way, because if you look at the 2007 order that he recently issued, it's quite clear that he sees it as a bare-bones temporary requirement. So there's no reason to think it would be a full-blown litigation.
I don't understand your response to Judge Garland's question, because he's trying to determine what standard the district judge would use.
Correct.
A is submitted as the selectee, and A is off the list. What does the district judge look at?
He didn't specify, so I can only hypothesize that it would be Title VII.
It isn't his gut reaction, is it?
No, we assume that it would be a Title VII standard.
Okay, so then we would have to assume then If the selection was off the list, that's prima facie evidence of discrimination, and then you go to a trial?
I don't believe so.
Then what else? How else could he proceed?
There would have to be some indication that the, some showing that the decision to promote off-list had a discriminatory motive.
What about in this case? Did you think it had a discriminatory?
There was no allegation of discrimination, merely that it did not comply, that the Cooper promotion did not comply.
I appreciate everybody's changed now, I guess. Maybe the same administrator there. What if she wanted the same person? What would you say?
If she wanted to go off-list, we would have to...
That exact same person. That is, I take it your objection to the person before was that it was off-list, not that
yes.
It was discriminatory. Okay, so now the administrator says, okay, I'm gonna bring back that same person again. You would say, we don't have any objection because we don't believe it's discriminatory, or you would say something else?
We would probably want to have some sort of discovery into the basis of the decision or some sort of justification for it, and based on that information.
What if the administrator said, this is my friend, which I take it something like what happened here, who I worked with for a long time, I know her to be very good, and that's why I appointed her. Would that be good enough?
That would not, yes, Your Honor, because it would satisfy the Title VII in this instance, only showing you the minimalness of the injunction at issue here, only to test the DEA's promotions off list, which isn't contemplated by the 1981 order for discrimination.
But I tell you, that's not exactly how you interpreted the injunction in this last go-around with the judge, right?
That is correct.
You interpreted it differently.
We interpreted it differently, and we were told that we were wrong. And the district court has made quite clear that it intends to enforce the 2006 injunction as a bare-bones, minimal injunction to only preclude a completely ad hoc process that was used, for example, in the Cooper promotion.
Okay, I think we have rebuttal time.
Thank you.
No time remaining. We'll give you a couple minutes.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Your Honor, I just want to clarify one thing, is that when we were discussing whether or not the administrator's authority was unfettered, there actually are, it's unfettered in a number of ways, but it has to comply with 3151 in that the person selected has to be a career civil service employee, has to have been an employee for at least 1 year. Unfettered to go off list, Your Honor, right, because the administrator does have to comply with Title VII, does have to comply with Rehab Act, does have to comply with conflict of interest statutes, anti-kickback statutes, and all of the other laws that could conceivably be brought into play.
But doesn't have to comply with all the text of the contract.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But you can enter into a contract which varies from that, can't you?
Pardon?
You can enter into a contract that varies from the section, from the statutory section.
Yes. Yes. So my conclusion, Your Honor, is that the court's injunction should be vacated, and that the court should find that DEA's interpretation of the stipulation was correct.
Can I ask one last question, which is, during the negotiations over this, did the government ever say to the other side, by the way, footnote one means that we can hire off list at the administrator's discretion at any time for any position?
Not exactly in those words, Your Honor, and unfortunately, there, based on what's in the record, and only what's in the record, which there were things that didn't get in the record, but based only on the record, the plaintiffs were told that there was a provision about the administrative authority that was coming.
Right,
that they needed to review.
They were never told to take a look at this. This means the whole thing's worthless.
Yes. I mean, isn't it fair that when two parties are negotiating, and particularly when one party is the government, that the other party doesn't have to assume that the government is going to say, there's a footnote here that totally eliminates everything else we previously negotiated for. And by the way, we're not going to flag that other than to say, oh, we got a footnote, take a look. I mean,
Your
when
Honor,
you're dealing
with
the government, don't you have to expect some amount of good faith in bargaining?
Your
the
Honor,
expression
I...
What given by a famous judge is we expect the government to turn square corners.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I believe the DEA did in this case. The DEA people that were working on this were consistent in maintaining the position that there was going to have to be some exception for the administrator's authority. Administrator Marshall sent the thing back and said it doesn't specifically say this, even though he was being briefed at the time that everybody understood that. For the DEA's position at the time was that everybody understood that there was a statute out here that set the parameters for what the administrator could
not do. So
you think
the government was completely upfront in the negotiations?
Pardon?
Do you think the government was completely upfront in the negotiations?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the government told the plaintiffs what was going on, and I believe the plaintiffs understood more than the district court made findings with regard to their understanding.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks very much. Thanks to both parties.